As Iyanla Van Zandt once said, it's important that we share our experiences with other people. Your story will heal you, and your story will heal somebody else. At Project Sleep, we believe that your stories matter, which is why we train people with sleep disorders on how to share their stories through our Rising Voices program. This Rising Voices podcast series features a variety of firsthand stories from people living with sleep disorders around the world. Each person's story offers unique and important insights.
Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Hello. So excited to introduce you guys today to Leah. Leah Boyle works in social media and has worked in a variety of industries from television to health. She lives in London and enjoys traveling and hiking, among other activities. She has lived with narcolepsy since she was 7 years old. She was diagnosed at 11 and is now a trained speaker for Project Sleep's Rising Voices of Narcolepsy. Neurological conditions are often invisible or misunderstood, so Leah aims to raise awareness of this condition by sharing her story. You guys are in for a huge treat tonight to hear Leah tell her powerful story. So take it away, Leah.
Okay. So hi, my name's Leah. So I was born and raised in London, in England. I had a very happy childhood. I was very confident and outgoing and energetic and always had an abundance of energy. So I grew up in the 90s. So I was a big Spice Girl fan. I was always singing and dancing their routines. I was part of a local theatre group. So I always liked performing and being on stage. I was also a pretty crafty kid. So I loved arts and crafts and anything that involved painting or putting things together. So my earliest memories of feeling sleepy are a little bit foggy because I was quite young, but my parents remember it quite differently. They remember a very sudden change coming over that I felt it was really hard to stay awake. So I went from being a really energetic and lively girl to one that just couldn't stay awake no matter how hard I tried. One example of this was in school. So I had a favourite teacher, like lots of people do. I was probably a bit of a teacher's pet. And I remember one day he asked us to design a poster for World War II. So I remember going to the library, getting all the materials, photocopying things, sticking them on. And the day came to present the poster. It went really well and he clapped and congratulated me. And then I went to sit down to listen to all the other students. As I sat down, my eyes felt really heavy and my jaw started to become quite weak along with the muscles in my face. Then the next minute I knew I was asleep. I remember the next moment being jolted back into the room by a really loud noise. I was a bit confused and didn't really know what it was. When I woke up, I realized it was my teacher clapping lots of times in front of me. I was a bit confused about why he'd done this. All the other kids in the classroom were looking at me. I'd just done a really good presentation, so it was a bit confusing to see why he was waking me up in such an abrupt way. But this happened quite a lot during school and during classroom experiences. So another experience I have of falling asleep or being sleepy was when I went to see Riverdance, which was a really popular theatre show of Irish dancing in the 90s. So me and my mum had planned for months to book these tickets and we finally got some. So when we arrived, the day arrived, we were really excited. I remember going to, we went to find the seats to sit down. really excited for it to start. And I remember that as soon as the curtains opened, I started to feel sleepy. I used my mum's shoulder as sort of a pillow to rest on and kept falling asleep every 10 minutes or so. Then the next minute, I remember hearing this hissing noise coming from behind me. We ignored it at first because it wasn't that big deal. But then it got a bit louder and it was a woman behind us. And she tapped my mum really abruptly on the shoulder and said, "What's wrong with you? Why can't you keep your daughter awake? You're ruining my experience of watching this show." So that was one experience of, we really enjoyed the show. It was a great show from what I can remember. But it's one experience of someone just not quite understanding or having a lack of awareness. Another thing that experience that I had was, at this age, I gained quite a lot of weight quite rapidly. Shopping became a bit of a struggle. So I remember going shopping with my mum again to Gap, which was one of my favourite shops. They had all the coolest clothes in my eyes at that age. So I remember wanting to try on some cool shorts and my mum having to break the news to me that they didn't have them in my size. And I had to go for the older kids or adult section now. So as well as being sleepy in the day, my nighttime sleep was also quite stressful and not very restful. I found it difficult to work out what was real and what wasn't, and whether I was awake or just dreaming. And I remember falling asleep at nighttime, items maybe in my room, such as like a towel hanging over a chair or a dressing gown on the back of the door. As soon as I was falling asleep, would morph into something else. And that something else became like a presence or a person. So these experiences became quite frightening. Another reoccurring one I had was always just as I was falling asleep, a hand would reach out from the back of my bed and tap me really abruptly on the shoulder and wake me up. And I'd wake up and there'd be nothing there. So over the years, I developed a few coping strategies for this. And I developed one I like to call dream planning. So before I went to sleep, I tried as hard as I could to think about really happy thoughts or things that I wanted to dream of that make me feel good. And this was what I'd do just before I went to sleep every night. At the time, I was a big Harry Potter fan. So I think I was probably influenced by some of the books. There's a moment in the books when he comes across these demon characters called Dementors. So if you're not familiar with the story, Dementors are soulless creatures that feed on human happiness and instill and replace any happy thoughts or feelings with fear and sorrow. So the only way to fight this or to fight against this is to conjure up a spell summoned by thinking happy thoughts. So you may be able to see some of the similarities there. So falling asleep at school and during activities I really enjoyed didn't seem quite normal for an otherwise healthy kid. So at the age of 7, after only a few weeks of falling asleep, my parents took me to see my local GP. During the first few visits, my symptoms were kind of brushed off and weren't taken very seriously. My rapid weight gain was often referenced. And they said things like, "Oh, she'll grow out of it," or "if she had a healthier diet, lost a bit of weight, did a bit of exercise, it will go away." My parents persisted and really pushed to ask for some more tests to find out really what the root cause was. So about a year later, when I was 8, I was sent to hospital for a number of tests. These included blood tests, x-rays, EEGs. I had all these tests, but they still couldn't find anything wrong with me. I remember the hospital experiences being quite scary for a kid. My dad was with me, I remember at the time, and was really reassuring. I remember him holding my hand, but no matter how good his reassurances were, I still felt poked and prodded like some kind of strange experiment. So when I was aged about 9, I remember going back to the doctor, being sent to another hospital and being seen by a specialist pediatrician. There was nothing found still, and it was suggested again that I'd grow out of it. And they diagnosed me with chronic fatigue syndrome. So my parents, especially my mum, who has a medical background and was a nurse, felt quite strongly that my symptoms didn't quite match up to someone living with chronic fatigue. So she still pushed through, and my father, to see what they could find or the root cause of it would be. So between the ages of about 9 and 10, my parents took me probably every 3 months or 2 months to my GP, and still kept telling them that nothing was getting better, but nothing was really done. And they weren't really given any support, or nothing was really further investigated. So eventually, after about 4 years, when I was 11, my parents had kind of had enough and still thought that there was more to this. So we decided to bypass the NHS system that we have in the UK and pay to see a private specialist. So in the UK, some of you might know, we have a free healthcare system. So it's a great system, but a lot of it is free. So to go to the extent to pay to see a specialist is quite a big deal. And I think it was at the time for my family, but they still say to this day that that was the best money they ever spent. So we did go to see a private sleep specialist. When I went to visit her then, I remember going into the room to visit her, and she asked me a few questions. I remember her speaking directly to me, which was really nice because that was the first time that had happened. Normally, the specialist conversations would happen with my parents. And she told me that she suspected I had something called narcolepsy. 10 days after seeing her, the private specialist, I was fast-tracked to have a sleep study. I was fast-tracked because I was a child and she saw the urgency in it. I had the sleep study free on the NHS, and then I was officially given the diagnosis of having narcolepsy. After we got my narcolepsy diagnosis, I learned that narcolepsy is a chronic neurological disorder that impairs the brain's ability to regulate the sleep-wake cycle. It affects 1 in 2,000 people, which is 3 million people worldwide. Major symptoms of narcolepsy are excessive daytime sleepiness. These are periods of extreme sleepiness during the day that feel comparable to how someone without narcolepsy would feel after staying awake for 48 to 72 hours. So those examples or scenarios I gave you of me falling asleep at school and falling asleep at watching Riverdance, these are examples of that. Cataplexy, so this is striking sudden episodes of muscle weakness, usually triggered by strong emotions such as laughter, exhilaration, surprise, or anger. The severity may vary from a slackening of the jaw or buckling of the knees to falling down. The duration may be for a few seconds to several minutes, and the person remains fully conscious, even if unable to speak during the episode. So I only have very light cataplexy, but those experiences I mentioned of sort of feeling sort of a lack of, you're feeling your face going funny or your sort of jaw slackening at school when I was falling asleep, those would be examples of it. So hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, these are visual, auditory, or tactile hallucinations upon falling asleep or waking up. These can be frightening and often confusing. So those experiences that I had in my room of those frightening visions, these were hallucinations. Sleep paralysis, the inability to move for a few seconds or minutes upon falling asleep or waking up. It is often accompanied by hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. It's important to know that people without narcolepsy can experience these hallucinations and sleep paralysis. In fact, about 1/3 of all people experience these at some point in their lives, usually during periods of high stress or poor sleep. For people with narcolepsy, these are much more frequent and consistent over time. Disrupted nighttime sleep. So unlike public perception, people with narcolepsy do not sleep all the time. Timing of sleepiness is off with narcolepsy. So one might fight sleepiness during the day, but struggle to sleep at night. Rapid onset weight gain. So people with narcolepsy also have a tendency to gain excess weight at the onset of narcolepsy. In children, this can be 20 to 40 pounds, and the body mass index in adults is approximately 15% above average. So the experiences there that I shared with you about putting on extra weight very rapidly, that was one of these symptoms. So there are two forms of narcolepsy, narcolepsy with cataplexy and narcolepsy without cataplexy. Recent research suggests that narcolepsy with cataplexy is caused by a lack of hypocretin, a key neurotransmitter that helps sustain alertness and regulate the sleep-wake cycle. Less is known about narcolepsy without cataplexy. Diagnosis usually includes a 24-hour sleep study that includes a nighttime portion, polysomnography, and daytime nap portion and multiple sleep latency test to record one's brainwaves. The diagnosis is mainly based on how quickly and frequently one goes into rapid eye movement, dream sleep stage during these tests. There is currently no cure for narcolepsy. Treatment for symptom management varies widely by person, but may include wake-promoting, histamine-directed, or stimulant to increase alertness in the daytime. This is what I currently take. I'm on a wake promoter. Nighttime medications to increase wakefulness and reduce cataplexy. Antidepressant medication to decrease occurrence of cataplexy. Scheduled daytime naps, which I have also found to be quite useful. And coping strategies widely vary from each person, but may include social support such as meetup groups or social media, improvement in general health and wellness through sleep, hygiene, diet and fitness. So having diagnosis before I entered secondary school had a lot of advantages. I found that it made it easier to be able to communicate to my teachers and my friends that I had something called narcolepsy instead of calling it my sleepy thing. Despite this, not everyone always understood. One time, we had a supply teacher for our maths class, and I remember going in, and within a few minutes of sitting down, I started feeling sleepy and started falling asleep. This happened a few times, and the teacher got very annoyed, and he sent me out of the classroom. He told me to stand there until he came out. When he came out, he continued to berate me and tell me how I shouldn't have been falling asleep very loudly so everyone else in the classroom could hear. I remember feeling rather annoyed, quite judged, and a lack of understanding of someone who I thought that was there to support me. So in school as well, having the diagnosis and medication also helped with many things. But in school, with the diagnosis, I was given extra time. I was given rest breaks and exams, and I was also given my own separate room. This made me feel less anxious during exams because I knew that if I needed to, I could take a 5-minute nap and it wouldn't impact my grades or my exams. So I also had a great support in a great support network with friends. And I had some very supportive friends who really helped. They often in class, I would not always be able to keep up with note taking. And I remember one time that I asked my friend to give me her book so I could write up the notes from that class that day. And as time went on, I didn't even have to bother asking her for her book anymore. And she just used to give it to me, which was a really small way that just that extra little bit of help and understanding really helps. So I went on to university. I went to Queen's University in Belfast to study history. I also became a student ambassador for the university. So we went to schools and talked about history. At university, with the diagnosis, I was given the same support I had in school. So I had rest breaks, I had extra time, essay extensions, and also a private room to do exams. I really enjoyed the freedom of being able to be in charge of my own study timetable, unlike school that can sometimes feel a bit structured. There were sometimes times when I found it a little hard to keep up and did struggle. And one time there was one history teacher in particular who noticed that I was falling asleep and maybe just not being as present there in my mind. So I remember one day that she asked me to come and see her at her office. And I remember feeling a sense of dread, thinking I'd done something wrong or that she was going to tell me something that I didn't want to hear. However, it turned out that she just wanted to offer some support. She said to me that she realized that I was a good student and that I might just need a little bit more attention and guidance. She took it upon herself to do this. She wasn't my like tutor or anything like that. And she would check in with me now and again and make sure I knew everything that I could get access to in the university. This kind of extra support and just investment really gave me that extra bit of confidence in my abilities. So after university, I went to teach English in Thailand. It was something that put me outside of my comfort zone, and being with new people and just a really, really sort of learning curve for me. So moving on to work, one of my career highlights was working at the BBC. I had a few different jobs when I worked there, but I found myself back working in history, which was great. So I was a PA and proposals assistant in the to two history commissioners, so of TV programmes. A part of this, the BBC had a scheme called BBC Extend. So being a part of that was really helpful, as it taught me how to communicate to employers what I needed living with narcolepsy, and then transferring that into the world of work. It's quite different from school and university. I found it was quite different. So learning how to do that was really beneficial. As well as this, I had access to other people who also had invisible disabilities. So I had that social support as well. And that was really, really helful. I went maybe two years ago, I went on the Santiago de Compostela pilgrimage, which is in northern Spain. So I've included this because I feel like living with narcolepsy is a little bit like being or going on a pilgrimage or a hike. For me, when I started this pilgrimage, I didn't really know what I was going to expect. So I knew I had a start point and an end point, but I didn't really know what was in between. So some days could be really huge, steep climbs, other days going over river streams and woods and lots of rain. You might be thinking why I'm saying this, but basically for me, I feel like every day is a little bit of a challenge living with narcolepsy. But no matter the challenge, I feel like I'll always pull through. It may be difficult, it may be hard, it may not be what I expect, but I have the hope and I have the optimism that things will get better and I can get through it. I'm also a natural optimist, so I envisage the future to be bright and hopefully full of more adventures like this. I might be sleepy, but at least I can say I've done it. I also work with Narcolepsy UK, so they're the charity here in the UK. They also did a really great charter, which was set up to promote people's rights who live with narcolepsy, what they should not have to fight for it. It promotes accessibility to early diagnosis, emotional and professional support. And the charter was put together by people who have narcolepsy and their supporters. So it's really informed by the people, which is lovely and really informative. They also have a helpline, which is a great resource for people to get some more support. They also have an annual conference. So because of low awareness, even among physicians, and misperceptions, there is an average of 8 to 15 years between narcolepsy symptom onset and diagnosis. For me, I first started experiencing symptoms when I was 7 and received my narcolepsy diagnosis 4 years later at 11. Even though it took a while to receive a diagnosis, having it when I was still young made a big difference for me. Having a diagnosis meant that I was able to get access to accommodations in school and receive treatment. So it's estimated that the majority of people with narcolepsy are currently undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. Common misdiagnoses include epilepsy, depression, and schizophrenia. So neurological conditions like narcolepsy are often invisible or misunderstood. So I hope that by sharing my story, I can help raise more awareness about the condition. I'm also sharing my story today as part of Rising Voices of Narcolepsy, a program of the non-profit organisation Project Sleep that empowers patients, advocates to share their stories and improve public understanding of narcolepsy. Thank you for listening to my story.
Yay, Leah! Great job! Thank you so much for sharing your journey.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
Leah, having been diagnosed at 11 and you're now like in your late 20s, early 30s.
Oh, so nice. Now I'm 33, but thank you.
All right. Well, I think that I have a theory that people with narcolepsy look younger, like, because I think I'm still looking pretty good, guys, and I'm 37. So I don't know what about that, if it's true or not. But so you've lived with narcolepsy diagnosed for a long time. Do you feel like you would have any tips for children that are newly diagnosed or for parents of children?
I guess if they're at school, it's about getting as much awareness and understanding from teachers, and not just the teachers themselves, but the wider teaching staff. Because like the example that I gave in my story, it was a supply teacher who wasn't my regular teacher, so we didn't really think to tell him. So just giving the wider school the understanding that they have a pupil in this. It doesn't need to be in like a, you know, in a public assembly, but at least within teachers' fit sphere, and everyone who works in the school should be aware. So then you just don't come across the lack of understanding and the judgment that comes with that. So I'd say reaching out to the school and however they can understand that it, you know, it is a genuine condition that people live with. And I guess the social support as well from peers, that's quite important, because they're quite formative years really, aren't they?
Do you feel like all of your friends at that age understood or were supportive, or certain ones? Or do you remember having any specific conversations that you tried to get them to understand?
I think it came down to luck. And I think I was incredibly lucky. Primary school, there were some kids who, kids can be mean, right? So there were some kids that just didn't understand or would make fun of you. But I had some friends that did, so that it made me quite hardy in that sense. In secondary school as well, I also had peers that had their own conditions as well. So we almost formed like a little tribe without knowing it, which was quite nice.
Yeah, that's really cool then. Because I think that when you're a kid, there's so much more pressure to almost be perfect, you know, or to feel like you should be perfect or not have something extra going on, you know, to be the same sort of. There's more. Do you feel like when you were in your teens, do you think that you would have known that you could have like taught school in Thailand and like, you know, gone on this great pilgrimage? Like, do you think that that was sort of a journey to get to that point?
I'd say they were more like dreams. They were more like aspirations of things that I really desperately wanted to do. And I was determined to do them whether I was asleep or not. I mean, I know it's not always possible. You know, traveling alone and stuff can be quite tricky. But yeah, I guess they were dreams and aspirations, and I felt so lucky that I was actually able to do them.
So I know you've mentioned the cool program at the BBC. I just wanted to highlight that once again, because I think that was really, what was it called again? BBC?
BBC Extend.
Extend.
It might be called something different now, but at the time it was called BBC Extend.
And so that offered opportunities specifically to people with different disabilities, is that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it was a range of other people that had it as well. Sorry, they had their own conditions as well. So it just sort of gave you extra support and extra guidance in really as well communicating what you needed, and all the employers. So all of the people that you had were all aware of your conditions. So there was no having to prep people or be like, this is what I have, because they all knew that the person that they had was like, you know, part of this scheme. And it was all really encouraged. So it was really nice to be a part of, actually.
Yeah. Do you think in a way, I don't know, because it's this program they had, it almost seems like it kind of celebrated, like that it was something they were proud of to do the pro. I don't know. I feel like I'm making this up in my head maybe, but.
They weren't really proud to do it. And because as well, the way that it was set up, it was it made the people involved in it feel quite empowered. So it wasn't just that, it was that there was access to so many other things. For example, so they had studios in London and in Manchester in the north of England. So they had one workshop that someone who was previously part of BBC Extend, but was now a permanent staff member in the BBC, she wanted to put on a presentation about living with neurological disorders. And I think at the time, just people weren't having those conversations. So she had a form of Asperger's, I think that's how you say it. So she put on a whole workshop about what neurological conditions are and wrote a paper on it, did extensive research. And this was just a side project of her normal job. So it was really empowering. And that was one event of many that we went to.
That's so cool. I just feel like I wish more companies had programs like that. I think that would be really empowering to a lot of people. Mm. So I'm glad that you got that experience. And let's bring that more places. So I think that, and if you did mention it, I just wanted to highlight it a little bit more. I don't know if you did though. You have, during the pandemic, I know from our own conversations, you've taken a more proactive approach to napping that I find very inspiring. Can you just highlight that for folks a little bit?
Yeah. So it started from the pandemic, because working in an office, there was space to have a nap, but I didn't always feel quite comfortable of sort of walking away from my desk, going into the room, putting up the sign. I just, some people can, and I admire those people, but I'm probably maybe just one of those people that just, you know, is a bit, I don't know. But so basically being at home and having my desk where I'm sitting now and my bed next to me, I was like, why don't I experiment with naps, with scheduled naps? So I started doing it, and I thought it was madness at first, because I thought, why do I want to go to sleep? Tell myself to go to sleep when I'm awake. That's what I had a hard time with. But I set myself a time every day after lunch, because after lunch, lots of people feel tired anyway, but that was my particular tired time. So I'd go and nap for like 15 minutes. And then I found doing that for about 2 weeks, I felt actually surprisingly more alert when I came back to working. And I think that was because I wasn't fighting the tiredness. So in my normal work day, I probably would be fighting the tiredness for about an hour and then have like an hour of brain fog just to top it up. So, but it's very difficult and to keep up. So I haven't been so consistent. So I stopped for a while, but now I'm back doing it again. I think I'm only 4 days into it again. Yeah, it's tricky, but it's sort of strange and helpful.
Yeah. So kind of that saying, take the nap before the nap takes you, you know?
Exactly.
But then when I try that, often I feel like, yeah, like you said, like you don't, if I'm feeling kind of okay, you don't really want to lay down and think, I can't fall asleep right now. I mean, I've done that many times. I'll be like, oh, I won't be able to sleep now. And then like 3 minutes later.
Yeah, well gone. Exactly. Like I had feel the exact same feeling. Like I was like, I'm wide awake. I'm in the middle of something. But as soon as I lay down, the sensation in my body was like, your body has been craving this. And asleep within three seconds.
Well, I love that. It's very personally inspiring. So thank you for sharing that with everybody. Okay, Lizzie has a question. She's been thinking a lot about people first versus identity first, language choice, and getting diagnosed early. Do you feel like narcolepsy is more integrated with who you are, or do you still consider it something separate? Has it changed? And she said, I hope that makes sense.
Oh, that makes so much sense, but it's such a tricky question to ask. Great question. So I guess you're kind of asking about your identity, and tell me if I'm going down the wrong direction. But for me, it's quite tricky because I was young and a kid, I don't have much of a memory of the person I was before I got narcolepsy. So it's a little bit tricky to remember that. And for me, it wasn't the diagnosis that then changed it for me, it was as soon as my symptoms started, that's when my life changed. Even though I don't have much memory before I was seven, I remember that there was an alertness and an abundance of energy that other people just had. And then I went to having like almost half of that, and just the feeling of not being able to keep up, having to work twice as hard just to do things that people found really easy. So for me, it was where my symptoms started rather than where I got my diagnosis, because the symptoms were quite harsh. In terms of getting the diagnosis, it was easier to communicate with people. So in that sense of where your identity comes in, it's more about being able to give people answers to something they want, because a lot of the time they're like, oh yeah, you feel tired, so you just feel tired. But being able to be like, no, look, this is what it is, these are the symptoms, made it easier for other people to digest, which in turn made my life easier. I don't know if that answered it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question, Lizzie, and it's definitely very complex. I think it's always kind of important to think about language choice, is that the reason that Project Sleep promotes people first language choice isn't about whether we have a sense of whether it's part of your identity or something separate. That's actually not part of the reason why we choose to use that language choice. It has to do with other people's perceptions of a group of people, which in this case is people with narcolepsy, and how those perceptions actually change based on the language choice. So kind of the concept that the words you use actually change your perception of something, which is interesting. So it doesn't actually have to do with whether or not people identify, you know, how we feel about ourselves and our own identity, or whether narcolepsy is like integrated or separate. That's not part of the decision making behind the choice that Project Sleep's made to promote the language choice that we choose. But that's just because kind of like misunderstanding and stigma and that separation is such a big deal, I think, too, for people with narcolepsy. So that's, anyway, let's see. Okay. Hi, everybody. My daughter was diagnosed last year with 10 years, almost like you. So I think maybe 10 years old. Do you think getting used to living with this early is much easier than adapting to it? Yeah. So basically, I think her daughter was probably 10 years old. So do you think it's easier possibly to be diagnosed younger than adapting to it later?
It's very different from person to person, isn't it? Each person's experience is different. I guess you have more armor. You've got more in your backpack to be like, well, this is a real thing. Here you go. Here are some facts. So it makes being able to explain to people why you're tired, why you're maybe not as alert. So it makes that part, I think, easier. But that's been my experience. And yeah, I would say having the diagnosis did help in that respect. If you asked me when I was 10, I wouldn't have said that. Or sorry, 11 when I got diagnosed. And then when I was a teenager, if you would have asked me that, I would have been very defensive. So, you know, your relationship with it can change as well. So,
great question. And thank you to Karina for supporting your daughter and being here. Supportive parents and loved ones are so important. Okay, what causes or triggered your narcolepsy, asks Elizabeth. And what are the different causes? Do you know what triggered your narcolepsy specifically?
There are lots of unknowns. They seem to just be theories. So for me, I think it has happened, or there have been cases with other people. So when I was seven, I had a very bad case of strep throat. So it was a virus. I think that's a virus. So they believe that, I'm not sure if I'm getting all these medical things right, but they believe that that could be a cause of someone getting narcolepsy. So that's possibly how I got it. But it's a theory, I think.
Yeah, the environmental factors could be upper airway infections like strep throat or a flu. I don't know mine, really. There's a theory. The only thing I can think of that connects to one of the times that my symptoms got a lot worse very quickly was I had an infected tooth. And I've asked some doctors about that. And they think that could be an infection that could have, you know, spurred on my body attacking that infection in my tooth. And then maybe, but that's just a theory. So that's the perfect way of putting it, Leah. Theories. All right. So Iris would like to know what you would say to someone who is scared to share their story.
Oh, that's a great question, Iris. It's a scary thing. It really is. Especially for me as well. Like I've hidden a lot of these things and I don't talk about these things very often, but it's not just about me. It's about how you can help other people, and sharing your story, I've realized, really does help other people. I mean, if I'd have heard some of these stories when I was a teenager, I would have felt like lots of your campaigns, Julie, like I would have felt so less alone. And it is that thing of just being able to tell people, you may feel like you're the only person with it, but there are other people with it and they're living their lives to the best ability that they can. And that's very inspiring. And I found it's been quite powerful.
And for you, I would just add a little bit that, I have a feeling that you've kind of uncovered through this process, you've almost uncovered more and more because your story, you've added more to your story in these beginning years over time that maybe it took a while to even remember. Yeah. As I'm thinking.
Yeah. The river dance example, I only thought of very recently, like last week. It came into my head out of nowhere. And I just remember my mum being really angry that this woman was so rude and so unsympathetic to someone who clearly could not, who wanted, like, well, obviously she didn't know me, this woman, but it was just the brashness of it. And yeah, it's been interesting process. I've really enjoyed it.
We have another question from Karina in Peru. She wants to know if you were able to do exercise at a young age, because, you know, that's a challenge for her daughter at a young age to exercise.
Yes. So I was not a sporty kid. So it didn't come naturally to me. It was hard for my mum to get me to exercise because I was tired and I had gained a lot of weight. So I sympathize if she has similar issues. But what we did do is we found something that, you know, wasn't focused on sport and fitness. It was just something I enjoyed. And those two things are still things I enjoy today, which are dancing. So I used to go to street dance classes and I loved it. And the teacher loved me too. And walking. So they're not, you know, they're not like huge competitive sport things. And I guess maybe they don't really have to. It's just about finding something that maybe you enjoy more.
Yeah. I mean, even to this day, I was just thinking this week about how I leave my house and I say I'm going for a walk. And I set my watch, I put it on walk. I do not put it on run because my intention is to walk. That's the only way I can get out of my house. And then magical things happen once I'm out there. Like I hear a good song or I, you know, have a little bit of a downhill. Oh, I'll just run the downhill. And then pretty soon I get going. But getting out the door, I have to just tell myself, just walk. And some days it is only a walk, you know, but it just doesn't ever seem to feel like, oh, I can't wait to go for a run. Like I don't have that energy right now. I'm just curious about the perceptions of narcolepsy in the UK. If you feel, yeah, I mean, so here in the US, like, there were some major movies that seemed to think it was a joke. So what's it like there? Did people think it was a joke or are they just not aware of it? Or
I'd say it's quite similar to the US probably. The mainstream media would be kind of like the comical aspects that you might get with it, or just sort of lighthearted, like, oh, well, they fall asleep. Ha, huh? That's funny. So it is quite similar to the US. And that is something that I would love to see change. Yeah, just because it's just too often that we see it portrayed in the same way, you know. Yeah, and yeah. Yeah, so nice to see that change across the world.
Well, we'll get there slowly but surely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that was it for everybody's questions. Thank you so much, Leah, for sharing your story tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone for tuning in. Bye.
The Project Sleep podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.